first encounter the Sufi path?
This particular Sufi, because there's a number of different tariqa, and I came across other tariqas at other times, but wasn't as drawn to them, because they weren't healership tariqas. I mean, I grew up in a household, not my household. I didn't grow up in my household. I grew up in Lex Hickson's household, and it was a household filled. I mean, it was like a mini Jerusalem, the real Jerusalem. It was a total interfaith thing. You'd be playing tag or hide and go seek and go careening into a rabbi or a Rinpoche, and they were Hindus in the basement, and you know, Eastern Orthodox priests in the dining room, and people from the Zendo, people holding Quaker meetings. It was this whole household full of serious religious practitioners, really wonderful people, some of whom took part in each other's practices and some of whom did not, but everybody took part in breakfast, which appeared to go on all day long. It was just that kind of household, and there were always kids running around, and I was one of them, and there were always grown-ups willing to sit down and discuss God with an 8-year-old, or 11-year-old, or 13-year-old, or, I mean, I don't remember how old I was exactly, must have been 10 or 11, and I was talking with Lex about God, and, or truth, or something, you know, some of these things, what living really is. And was because like these were people who had really figured that they would probably learn something by talking to a child about these things, which made it an incredible engagement. And I remember saying to Lex, you know, Lex, this is a good conversation, but I look forward to talking with you about it again when you're older.
Is he an adult?
Yeah, he was in his 40s probably at that point, and I was about 10. But I still understand what I meant. There was some intimation of what was going to come through when he became an old man. Because things come through to people who are old, you know, that just don't come through. I mean, men and women, but in his case, it was more that feeling of the wisdom that we only have when we can't count on our body to provide an irrational basis for confidence. And I think men especially really hit that one, sometimes rather hard. That kind of irrational testosterone confidence. I feel strong, I must be right. And things are fine. And then it's like, oh, that's not there. Where do I get my strength and sense of certainty and sense of confidence from? Because it's not a freely available physical experience anymore. So I couldn't have articulated any of that at the time. But so there were Sufis there, certainly. The Jarahi order, he actually became Sheikh Nur al-Jarahi, a Sheikh of the Jarahi Sufi order. And they were beautiful. And so were the Quakers, and so was the Rinpoche, and so were the Hindus. I mean, it was just completely amazing to jump off this catwalk onto Lex's 4-poster bed in which he was sitting editing proofs of Ramprasad's hymns to Kali that he just translated, and he just looked at me. He looks like a lion. He just looked at me and said, listen to this, and started reading these hymns to Kali, and I lay down on the floor and just felt my soul carried. Changed. It changed me forever. It gives me chills thinking about it now, what that was like, and then got up and went back to the game. So I was exposed to Sufism, and I was exposed to many paths beginning very early, but none of them was my path until this one, because this one's a healership guild. And it's specifically focused around my personal spiritual progress via becoming a better and better healer. I mean, there's bricklaying ones, you know, or there used to be, you know, or way different guilds whereby the spiritual practice is tied into meal making, or, and this one is, it's tied into healership. It's in a sense that's the means and the measure. I first encountered it I got a flyer in the mail saying that this guy, Ibrahim Jaffe, was going to speak. And I looked at it and I said, huh, he looks familiar. Then I put it aside. Couldn't shake that feeling that he looked familiar, though. And then Greg Lee said to me, you have to come to this gathering. You have to. And it was like, there was something like a $25 donation in order to come to this. There was a weekend thing, and there was also this just little more informal gathering in someone's living room. And he said, I will pay for you to go. You have to go to this gathering. And so I said, okay. And I went, and I walked in, and Ibrahim looked at me and said, you look familiar. But we hadn't met anywhere, and he just kept looking at me and saying, I can't shake this feeling that you look familiar. And then there we were sitting in this group of around 20 people on the floor in someone's living room. The people were asking him questions, and he went around the room basically telling each person the truth about themselves, straight to their face, with so much loving compassion that there was no shame and no hurt in it. And it was astounding. It was absolutely astounding to see somebody able to speak truth. So spade is a spade out there with no injury done, even though some of the things he's had to say, with any lesser four-wheel drive level of love would have been devastating. But it wasn't. It wasn't at all. And I just, something inside of me said, I want to be like that when I grow up. That's what I want to do. I want four-wheel drive love that allows me to tell the truth right to people's faces, even about them, so that it's not shame and it doesn't hurt. I want to love like that. I want to learn that. It was sort of hook, line, and sinker. He would tell everybody the truth to their face, and at first they totally wouldn't get it. Like, everybody else could say, like, what do you mean I'm holding anger in my father? You know, that kind of situation. Everybody's like, oh. They just stood completely revealed in love, you know? And then you'd see them about 15, 20 minutes later, their whole body would suddenly melt. As they were like, got it. So he did that with that, with everybody, telling them the truth, even though they didn't get it right away. Except for me, of course, what he said about me definitely wasn't true. Until about 20 minutes later, when all of a sudden I went, oh, yeah, okay. And by the end of the evening, he turned to me and said, okay, do you want to take the promise and become a Sufi right now? And I definitely did that thing that I was speaking of before, where my mind, which, oh God, was I top heavy in the head. I mean, was even more top heavy in the head. And I just started talking about every single reason why all these questions, I have all these questions. It's like all these questions that I had about it, and meanwhile I can feel my heart getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And he takes my hands and said, I promise you Allah. And all the questions just went pop, and I burst into tears and started taking the promise with him. And by the end of that, I just started sobbing uncontrollably and then laughing absolutely hysterically and then sobbing again, and then sat there, you know, for a good 45 minutes saying, who am I? Who am I? Because I'd never been to a place beyond my mind. Never been there before. I'd never gotten out from the cage of the grid of how I think about it intellectually into a place where my heart just ran out of the cage. I'm not staying here anymore. I'm not staying. I'm running. I'm going. This is it. What is that Rumi poem? I would like to kiss you. The price of kissing is your life. Now my love is running for my life, saying, what a bargain, I'll buy it. It was like that. It was huge. And then, for some reason, there was some administrative error, because he wasn't expecting to have somebody take the promise. And so I just dropped into a void and heard nothing more from anyone about it for 6 months. And 6 months usually is about the period of time when, if you take the promise, if you actually initiate. I mean, all of these practices are available to anybody. If you actually initiate into it, it's basically being joined to a transmission that goes all the way back to the Prophet Muhammad and before him to the angel Jibril and Allah before that. And it's this, it's sort of like a river. I mean, it felt, not to be really crude, but it really felt like being flushed down a toilet. It was just like some big whoosh came up and it just carried me out. And all of a sudden I'm floating in the ocean. I'm like, how the hell did I get here? I was in this small confined space and now I'm this other place. Wow. And when we take the promise, we're promising to be truthful, to be sincere, to walk in the way of the prophets, to live for Allah. I mean, I can get the words for you somewhere. They're very simple and very, actually fairly non-denominational in a lot of ways. We're making a promise, but the promise goes two ways. We're saying, hear this promise, hear this intention. But what we're getting in return is that now an entire lineage transmission beginning with Allah and all these heavy hitters through history are now going to be actively holding us to that promise. Which means that on my own, I can walk the path. And if I don't walk, I stay right here. Having joined a lineage transmission, someone's pulling all the time. And if I stay still, I'm going to feel the tug. And if I try to get away from it, I'm going to feel the tug. And when I say get away, I don't mean get away from anything outer. I mean get away from what they're really training us in. All of the teachers in this, they're not training us to be obedient to them. They're training us to be more and more perceptive from here, to be able to hear the voice ourselves and not listen to the nafs and not listen to the shaitan, except for the information it gives us about where we need healing, and go where this says go. So it's like a two-way promise. It's saying, this is what I want to do with my life, is give myself to walking to Allah, walking straight, not left, not right, and I want you to call me on it every single minute of my life. It becomes a lot harder to not pay attention. I think that's the main advantage of it, is that there's a continuous suction that's very helpful. Again, it doesn't necessarily make you go to any meetings or wear funny hats on your head or do anything in particular. It's really about a relationship of the heart to the divine, and there are many people who are living in a Jewish practice or living in a Catholic practice or living in whatever their practice is and are considered Sufis and are considered part of the tariqa, but the way they walk it is the way that between them and Allah is the straight path. The whole metaphor of the tariqa, a tariqa means a way or a path or literally a spoke of a wheel. The idea is that there's the wheel, the outer rim of mundane, ordinary existence, and the hub of the wheel, which is the experience of the divine, the totality. And there are many different spokes, and there have to be. It's an inconceivableness of there being a right way. And the Catholic Church is a tariqa. And Hasidism is a tariqa. And Buddhism is a tariqa. And we may be on different spokes, and thank goodness, you know, different spokes for different folks. And that's what keeps the wheel from collapsing and makes it so that you can get there from here, wherever you are. And so it's not a determinant of the particulars of your tariqa. It's a determinant of the inexorable draw from the rim of the wheel to the center of the wheel. Yeah. So that's how I originally encountered Sufism. And then there was that 6 months of, I mean, it's usually the first 6 months after taking the promise that you sort of feel like your entire life, even if nothing externally has been turned upside down, suddenly it feels turned upside down because now you're dedicated to God rather than getting the proposal in on time.
and yet you still have to get the proposal in on time. And there's a kind of jumbly inner feeling of reorganization. Oh, yeah, I see you. Yes, a kind of jumbly inner feeling of reorganization of how do I manage this? There's this wheel, there's this hub, there's this spoke that I'm walking, there's these proposals, there's this orientation of my soul, and eventually it starts to feel sort of like driving in the rain with the windshield wipers going, such that, I mean, you see the windshield wipers, and you know there's a proposal. It's all there in line of sight, but there's something about being more aware of where I'm headed, and secondarily aware of the territory that I'm passing through and the 25-mile-an-hour zone signs, and all of those things are in awareness also. So I went through that 6 months entirely on my own with no idea what the heck, and no idea that there was another way that things usually were done or anything like that. Given what happened next, namely me spitting in the face and throwing tantrums at anybody who tried to tell me anything about anything, because I was so smart and I knew lots about religion. It's probably great that I had those first 6 months with nothing to argue about and nobody to fight. Just this total void of an experience of my heart being changed and nothing that I could think about it. So I think it was a blessing. I think it was, as we say in Yiddish, I think it was beshertz. I think this was an intended thing. But most of the time it's not like that. You need to take the promise. You have, so there's a local Sufi teacher who's available to answer questions. There's a master, there's a whole network of whatever. And also I didn't get my name. A Sufi, you get a name when you take the promise. Sufi looks at your soul and says what your soul quality is and gives you a name, and it's probably a great thing that nobody told me that my name was Mariam for a good 6 months. Mariam meaning Jesus's mom, which I had a hard time with. I mean, I know she was a nice Jewish girl also, but I had a really hard time with it. I was like, what's Arabic for rhinestone mud flap, okay? Maybe that could be my Sufi name, because I don't identify with no virgin for one thing. I don't think I ever was one. And I also didn't know, I mean, all I knew was the distorted Catholic Mariam, not even the real Catholic Mariam, but the distorted Catholic Mariam, which is part incubator and part cow. And I just couldn't relate to that. And all this shit about purity, I mean, what purity? Purity? Come on! So I had to do some exploding about that, and I actually had to hang out. And also, Mariam, I mean, my name is Thea, you know? How many people do you meet named Thea? In the Tariqa, how many people do you meet named Mariam? Well, maybe 500 a day? I'm a dime a dozen! I have a hard time with being a dime a dozen! I was like, hey! I'm unusual! Oh, that was so hard for me. That was so hard for me not to have an unusual, exotic name that nobody's heard of before. I'm really different from everyone else! Mary? Your name is Mary? Virgin Mary? And I wasn't a mother at that time either. I just couldn't relate. I completely couldn't relate. I get it now. I mean, I get it now. I'm partly because I feel Mariam more now and really understand both in terms of the aspects, the luminous aspects. It's so hard to talk about. It's just so hard to admit. It's still hard to admit it. It's still really more comfortable thinking of myself as a rhinestone mud flap. I guess the first time I actually grudgingly got it, that it made sense that my name was Mariam, was when my acupuncture school classmates were reminding me of my contribution to the discussion on client-practitioner relationship. And I was saying that as far as I was concerned, proper practitioner-client relationship is saying to the client, you're God, and I'm your mother. Okay. That really is it. I mean, that really was it. You are the divine being, and you know, somebody's got to change the divine being's diapers. Somebody has got to say, Jesus, it's bath time. Right? You know, somebody's got to deal with the snarls and the poops and the burps and the need to be fed of a divine incarnation. And that's what Mariam is for, is being able to see the divine in a poopy diaper baby or a struggling adolescent or whatever crazy incarnational thing, but be able to see this, you know, here you are. And you are God, and I'm going to help take care of God and get you on your feet and get you going. And I also got it when it was through one of my teachers who was talking about being present to other people's pain and talking about the spirit of Mariam as what it takes to stand there and watch your son die painfully, in agony and despair, on the cross, and not run, and not collapse, and not hide your eyes, and not shield your heart, but to stay right there with that every single moment and be alive and compassionate and able to be with the pain of this world. Right there, and love. Love through the unendurable pain. And something in me said, yeah, whether or not I always achieve it, I will always be. That's what I'm always about, is that kind of rugged four-wheel drive. That's Mariam. She wasn't collapsed in a heap. She was right there, right there, right there. Helpless, not able to do anything about it, one could say. But giving the one thing that can be given, a womb, and embracing love, what to say, like so, Mariam. I also got it by asking a whole bunch of Mariams to all have lunch with me. So about 9 of us all sat at the same table, and as it happened, we were all in a pissy mood, too. So I got to be with 9 other Mariams in a pissy mood, and we were all in the same kind of pissy mood. It was really cool. We were all totally pissed from the eyebrows up. From here up, intellectually, we're just like, and underneath that was the rest of the ocean, and the ocean was frankly big and vast and fine. Just up here, like, okay, I'm like these women. My name is Mariam. And there is something in the Mariam essence that is so hard to talk about. This is the part that's really hard to talk about. That really does have a quiet purity. This is going to be easier to speak about if I speak about it in all of us, because it is absolutely in all of us. Again, I'm thinking about a client right now who really just thinks that she's the scumbag whore of the universe, really. The slut of filth, all this that she thinks she is, based on what she has done with her body and her sexuality and her history, and the ways in which she has felt that she has dirtied herself, that she's the least pure, especially physically and sexually, person. And I suspect that she is also a Mariam, but in a sense we all are, we all have this. Every woman a Mariam, every man Muhammad, they have this in common. A part of us that only gives ourselves away to the prophetic light. That says, I give this only to the true beloved. I am the beloved of God and of no one else. That there is an inner virgin that, try as we might to run wild, stays inside and waits for holiness before saying yes. Waits for sexuality and communion to be sanctified, a sanctified moment. And that may well occur with a human, or it may occur directly with the divine, but that this flower does not open under any other circumstances. And no matter what the rhinestone mudflap gets herself into, this flower stays in bud form, completely virgin and pure, until the Holy Spirit comes to it, and then it says yes, and opens. So often when we get a name, it's not always quite as rough a road as it took me years to be able to deal with letting anyone call me Mariam, because I just, who I thought I was had nothing to do with who I thought Mariam was. Both turned out to be completely wrong. But often the name that we get is something that is a real blow to our sense of identity on the level of the nafs, and that it's a bit of a journeying to come home to what our name is. And then to make it even crazier, every now and then Sidi will change your name, and what that means I have no idea, except that it seems to happen at times when a person has made a very significant shift, and maybe, I don't know, some others, for instance, I've noticed that a lot of people named Naeem or Naima often lose their name and get another one. I've noticed that a lot of people named Jamil and Jamila often lose their name and get another one. And that I think it may be something that, I don't know. I'm almost afraid to say anything because it could be totally wrong and I don't want to be misleading. But I have noticed that. My son, for instance, is now Ahmed, but that's fairly recent. And when he was born, well, I didn't know what it was. I called up Sidi and I told him my son was born and I asked for his name. And Sidi says, "His name is Ho!" I said, "Thank you, Sidi. Could you say that for me one more time?" He says, "Yes, yes, his name, Ho!" I said, "Oh, thank you. Could you say it just one more time?" I said, "Thank you very much, Sidi." Hung up, crestfallen. Called him right back again and said, "Sidi, I'm really embarrassed to ask, but I don't think I got my son's name clearly." I was like, you know, going the whole, I mean, you know. "Could you say it more slowly?" And he goes, "Whoa!" I hung up, I said thanks and hung up, and I waited 10 minutes, and then I called back again and I said, "Sidi, feeling really smart, could you spell my son's name?" I don't even know if he knows how to spell in English, okay? I don't have a faint sight, but
you're calling Jerusalem?
I'm calling Jerusalem. Okay. About this. And he finally says, "Ha! Da! Ra! Salaam alaikum!" And so I was able to consult with the teacher. Hadra is his name. Hadra means zikr circle. And he did later become famous for getting out of my arms in the zikr circle and going wildly dancing in the zikr circle. So that was his thing. And then at a certain point, was it when he took the promise, or was it a few days afterwards, he took the promise. It was really an amazing occasion. He was around, how old was he? Maybe 6 or so. It was one evening, we were out at the Sufi school and Sidi was there, and it was nighttime, and he asked me a lot of different questions about the promise, and then at one point I thought he'd fallen asleep, he wailed and he said, "Mama, how old do you have to be before you can take the promise?" And I said, "Oh, sweetie, I don't know. They usually say that children are the promise. They don't have to take the promise. But I'll find out." And we just spent more time talking about it and what it meant. And the next day, after Sidi finished his teaching, but as it turns out, hadn't turned off his microphone, Josh went up and asked him, "Sidi, how old do you have to be to take the promise?" And CD says, right now! And gives my son the promise with his little piping voice repeating his vows across the entire auditorium. It was a beautiful, beautiful thing. Then the rest of the next few days he had to sit in my arms because, I mean, you know, I was going through reorganization of all that stuff. And a few days after that he said, I need to ask Seedy about my name. Just like something, and he went up and asked Seedy, he said, Seedy, I need to ask you about my name. And he said, ah, your name Ahmed. Which, and he said, what does that mean? He who says thank you to God. So names change, and it's usually at some significant point, and I don't really know that much more about it. I love knowing the names. It's a really amazing thing. It's wonderful in large gatherings where there's lots of people with the same name to hug all their Rakhmas one after another and get the Rakhma feeling and go hug a bunch of Jamilas and Jamils and get, oh, what does this soul essence feel like? I think that extremely fully answers the question.
I've got the question.
How did I first get introduced to Sufism?